taking a ride on the Freedom Train, your community resource podcast series. I am your conductor, Joseph Ward, and as always, ride with me, it's my good friends, Mr. Patrick Irvin, Mr. James Bouchon. The Freedom Train is sponsored by PACS Inc., that's P-A-C-T-S-I-N-C. And PACS Inc. is a black advocacy organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the traits of hard work, honesty, and integrity. And for more information, make sure you visit www.pactsinc.org. And also, make sure you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com to learn more about us and hear the playbacks of your favorite shows. Also, make sure you follow us on Twitter and Instagram at _FreedomTrain. And last but not least, subscribe to the Freedom Train podcast on iTunes and Google Play Music. Patrick, Jamie, how y'all doing today? What's up? What's up? What's up?
What's going on, good people? How y'all doing, man?
Not much, man. Not much. How's the family?
We good, man. We still trying to recover in this post-Trump election. We trying to recover, so
we'll get that too. What about you, Pat?
I mean, we still alive, so, you know.
Agent Orange didn't mess no. That's my name for him, Agent Orange. So Agent Orange didn't mess it up for too many people, huh?
Nah, not too much.
Cool. So, on the show today, I'm excited because we have author Dorothy Swigert on the show today, and she is the author of Silence is a Democracy, Prisons for Profit. Ms. Swigert, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for being on our show. And before we get into the questions, I want to give people a little background information about you. I don't want to go too far because I don't want to spoil anything, but I do want to give a little background information about you. Okay. Dorothy Swigert has her roots in Alabama, nurtured in the civil rights state outside of Birmingham. Bathed in the culture of Southland, embracing the community culture and spirit and philosophy of live and let live. Wrote her first play while attending Tuskegee, enjoyed the golden years of such a beautiful campus with caring and nurturing professors who cared about the total development of students. Some of my most precious memories are locked on this lovely campus. She began her teaching career as a junior high school at a junior high school in Brooklyn, New York, with a rainbow population of spongy students who were thirsty for knowledge. She was a teacher, and they were her sponges, eager and ready to absorb all knowledge, especially her supplemental teachings of infusing black history into the American history curriculum. Because they were such lovely students, she stated, she cultivated them and loved them and gave them a love and desire to participate in dramatic activities and presented theatrical performances at school assemblies. She earned a bachelor's degree from New York University and was a member of the campus theater. She further developed her talents and interests in becoming a playwright. So, and that's the farthest I'm going to give you, because if I go a little further more, I'm going to give it away. But I would like to introduce to you, once again, Miss Dorothy Swigert. So our studio audience, there you go. Yes, ma'am. Thank you once again for being on this show.
It is my pleasure, and I thank you very kindly for inviting me.
Oh, no problem. All right. You know how Patrick, Jamie, y'all know how we do this. Patrick, you got the first question. Jamie, you up next. Let's roll.
And it's nice to see that our studio audience is finally tired of me bagging on them every week.
Hey, the man with the little shirt and the sign, he back on it. So.
All right. So I guess the very first question has to be, Silence in a Democracy, Prisons for Profit. That's the name of the book. Why did you write the book? Like, what was your motivation for it, and why did you decide to give it such a provocative title?
Okay, thank you very much for that question. Silence in a Democracy, Prisons for Profit. That is very interesting, because to really just let you know what happened, yes, I did work as, I had a prison ministry in Concord Baptist Church in Brooklyn, New York in the 1980s, because, you know, I had received my Master of Divinity from New York Theological Seminary. And that seminary always wanted us to go out into the community and do work and not just sit in a pulpit. So I chose for my ministry the prisons. And so what I did is I organized a group to go to the prisons. And I was really appalled at what I saw in the prisons, but I really didn't know that I did not know why the prisons were so full.
Right.
I mean, there was a large population of students who, you know, could not read, could not write, the illiterate population. Then we had the mentally ill, then those that were addicted, and those who were who were infected with the HIV virus.
Uh-huh.
But let me tell you exactly what caused me to write Silence in a Democracy.
Uh-huh.
I was sleeping in my bed in July 2014, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon me and said, get up and research the prisons. And so I obeyed. I got up, and I began my research. And what I found was appalling to me. And that's when I said, oh, my goodness, we have already been re-enslaved. When I realized the research that I had gone into, I had, you know, gone on the Internet, had done a lot of research, et cetera. So I went downstairs and I said to my son, who was visiting me that weekend, I said, do you realize that we're already re-enslaved? And so we went on with that. Now, of course, Silence in a Democracy, that title came to me because, you know, as I taught my students, democracy, you know, when you syllabicate, you divide the words so that you can understand the meaning. So demo would mean people, and krisi, government, so the people's government, a government by and for the people. So Silence in a Democracy, the question is, all of the people being treated equally, justly? And if not, why are the people so silent? Why isn't someone talking about the prisons? Why are we in a democracy with three branches of government, the legislators, the judicial, and the executive, and everyone is silent about what is happening in the prisons? So that's really what inspired me in that direction.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Go ahead, Jim. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that was pretty good. I like that. My question is, I want to go back to the beginning. You grew up outside of Birmingham, attended Tuskegee University. Early on, how did, you know, racism impact your life, if it had an impact? And how did those experiences early on in your college days, growing up in Alabama, how did that really help you as a black woman and becoming a black author? How did it really shape your outlook on life and how you approach your books and your writing?
Well, that's a very good question, too, because, I really grew up in Fairfield, the outskirts of Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
And what I say to most people is that Fairfield was a true village. It was truly that home, that church, that school, and that community working together to form the character of children. And so what we had during those years, during the 50s to 60s, we had a caring community.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was that church, it was that home, it was that school. And these institutions were united together to form the character of children. In fact, when I think about it, our preacher, Reverend E.W. Williams, was truly the center of that community.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, he had a big Cadillac, and he rode through the community, and he really surveyed the community to see what was going on. And on Sunday morning, he would return to that First Baptist Church, and he would talk about what he saw in the community. Anything that he did not like or did not think should be occurring in that community, he spoke about it. And he'd come into that church, and he'd say, you ladies, What are you doing? You're not taking care of your children? Their hair standing all on their head? You take care of your children. You nurture your children. And then when he would look around and he'd look at the men, and he would say to the men, if the Lord wanted you to smoke, he would have put a chimney on your head. And then of course, we had the high school, so E.J. Oliver was the principal of that school, and so the principal and the preacher worked very close together.
Mm-hmm.
And the preacher would invite the principal to speak at our church, and the principal invite the preacher to come to the school. So this is where you get that unity. This is where you get working together. And so that you have your hands on your children in your village, and you can really monitor the progress and the growth of the children. And what the preacher would say to the teachers in that church, we want you to teach these children on par with everyone else. And, you know, during that time we had a Catholic school. And so he made it clear, I do not care if the children in the Catholic schools are excelling. I want you to make sure that you are teaching the children in the public school on par with everyone else. And so in that community, education had the highest priority. And the teachers worked together with the parents, and the parents worked with the teachers. It was that kind of setup where if you were chastised by your teachers, and you better hope that that information did not get home to your parents, because you were going to get a second punishment. And so that was that unity. Now, about me and how it affected me, well, in our community, we had our own, we were segregated. Therefore, we had everything in our community. We could see all of our entrepreneurs. We had the doctor who ran the drugstore. We had the doctor who was a physician. We had the shoe shop. We had all of this. So we did not have to run around and try to find models to emulate. They were right in our community. Mm-hmm. And so that was that nurturing process. And about me writing and about my history and my past, in high school, we had so many extracurricular activities, so you develop your gift, skills, and your talents. And I know my history teacher, when I first began high school, I was just flabbergasted. When I walked in her classroom, she had photos of outstanding blacks posted all around her classroom. And once a year, she had that, what we call Negro History Week. Remember Carter G. Woodson, the founder of Negro History Week in 1926?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
okay. So we were cultivated in that kind of heritage, because our teachers and our parents had come from the difficult days of slavery. My parents were the second generation from slavery. And so they nurtured us. One important thing, get your education. Education is important. Get your education. And, of course, you had your aunts and your uncles who were cheering for you. And it was no such thing as low self-esteem and you're not worth anything, because everyone was telling you that you're great, you're going to be somebody. So I think that made all the difference. So when I began to teach, I sort of like integrated my childhood, my culture, my values into my lesson plans to inspire and to motivate children to realize that they too are important persons.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I love that. And because it the way you sum that up leads into our next question. And like we said, you grew up in Alabama outside of Birmingham, and you attended Tuskegee, and you became a teacher. And as a teacher, what did you learn about the importance of teaching black children black history? And in your opinion, is black history really truly needed to be taught in the schools?
I would ditto that 100% plus.
Mm-hmm.
100% plus. It makes all the difference in a child's life. And to really put a little light on that,
yes, ma'am.
I remember when I began teaching in the junior high school in New York City, and when you began to talk about blackness, the students would start declining in their seats, you know, because they were ashamed, you know, because the only thing they had learned about was the two persons, Booker T. Washington, George Washington Carver, and they didn't know about all the other great inventors, the scientists, the biologists, pioneers, the entire work. And so when I, well, first of all, I was truly blessed because I was taught black history in high school. We had a course. We had Carter G. Woodson's book in high school. And when I went to Tuskegee, I was blessed to the highest level. I mean, I had Professor Tolan, who taught black history, and he used John Hope Franklin's book. How many of you have heard of John Hope Franklin? Have you?
No, ma'am.
Oh, you can't get through black history without that.
They
okay,
failed.
The name of this black historian is John Hope Franklin.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
He passed a few years ago. Well, John Hope Franklin was the most erudite historian for black history. So make a note of it, John Hope Franklin.
Yes, ma'am.
In fact, most writers who wrote about black history always reference his book. And the title of the book is From Slavery to Freedom.
Okay, and I know the book. Yes, ma'am, I have the
from
book.
Slavery
I have his
to
book.
Freedom.
Yes, ma'am.
And I mentioned that book because while I was at Tuskegee and I had this black history class under Professor Tolan, I had the opportunity to meet John Hope Franklin because the professor was using his book to instruct our class. And so what I did, I said, okay, I'm going to do, I enjoyed the class. In fact, the professor loved it so well until you would think the way he was patting his foot when he taught the course, you would think for sure he was munching on the steak back in that time. But it is that history that molds and shapes the heart of a person. One cannot do all that one can do if one does not have an important outlook of who he is or who she is, that you are a very important person on this earth. And so what I did, I said, okay, I'm going to do what I need to do to pass this course. But when I graduate, get my degree, I'm going to sit down and I am going to read this book from cover to cover. And that was the beginning of my background in black history.
Uh-huh.
Those 500 pages were few pictures, and I read from cover to cover. And my heart was just nurtured. In fact, my sister used to say, Freedom, you got to stop reading and do some eating now. You just can't read. But it was so fulfilling. And so what I did, I just began, writing the information in a way that I could, you know, transmit it to my students.
Mm-hmm.
And so the great information that I received from my students in this junior high school was, so we thank you so much for being our teacher because we didn't know anything about our history. And you could see how the transformation in their lives about themselves, that I, too, am an important person. I, too, have gifts, skills, and talents. I have something to look forward to in life. And, of course, the drama part was that I would engage them in plays, you know, depicting the lives of outstanding blacks. And, you know, like Dr. Daniel Hale Williams, the first open-heart surgery to life, or Dr. Charles Drew, which it was the blood bank. You just go straight down the line and you would just see there's no end. And the one person who could put a caption to this would be Carter G. Woodson.
Yes, ma'am.
Prodigy Woodson said as he dedicated his life to the study of black history. He was so into black history, he didn't even bother to marry. Anyway, he wrote so many books, and he really dedicated his life to studying every aspect of American society and the impact that it had on the children. You've heard of the book, The Miseducation of the Negro.
Yes, ma'am.
And the most important statement that I love about him was he said, if black people were credited for all the work that they have done, they would be crowned as leaders of civilization. That's
yes,
what
ma'am.
He gave them.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
What he said was, as he went into libraries and museums and archives, he found that many contributions and inventions that were given to others really were done by black people. And you know what? I had the opportunity to experience that because I participated. I was selected one of 40 educators to participate in a Black History Conference, the National Institute for Study of Black History, so that you will return to your schools and infuse it into the curriculum.
Okay.
And so I work with the district writing black history and infusing it into the curriculum. And what I found out was it was quite, you know, appalling that so many books had distortions. And so what we did, we just weeded out those books that had distorted the history. And when you get to Silence in a Democracy,
mm-hmm.
I write about some of those books. And so, in other words, we had to get into those books and eliminate books that distorted the history of black people. And see, like Carter G. Woodson had said, we would have a Negro History Week in 1926. But the ultimate goal was to ensure that black history would be completely integrated into American history. That's
mm-hmm.
how big it was. And so
yes,
we
ma'am.
Were really, during those 60s, fighting to achieve that goal because we knew the positive impact that it would have upon the children.
Yes, ma'am.
Now that is beautiful.
Right.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir.
I'm a historian myself, so yes.
How good.
So let me ask, what would you say has been the most powerful or transformative thing that you've learned about yourself as a black person?
Well, the most important thing that I have learned as a person in my lifetime is, first of all, that God is real and that God has equipped each and every one of us with gifts and talents at birth. And if we apply ourselves, get our education, and develop our gifts and talents, then we can impact the world in a positive way to reach out to uplift humanity as well as to make this a better world. In fact, that's how you see where I introduced John F. Kennedy in the first chapter of my book.
Uh-huh.
And in the first chapter, he is talking about his Peace Corps. And that information is to show that nations should come together in peace and share information. And we should be trying to live in harmony, sharing our gifts, sharing our culture, and not just in militaristic wars. We're out there trying to take someone else's territory and destroy what they have. If we were able to recognize that, wait, this nation has something great, and this nation has something, and we have something, and we will come together in sharing so that we can make this a better world and recognize all human beings as worthy to make a contribution to living on God's earth.
Okay. Right. So, well, I want to ask this, and it's off the beaten path, but how long did it take you to write the book, and did you publish the book the traditional route, or did you self-publish, and why did you choose that route for your book?
Okay, the book, I received the assignment July 2014. The book completed October 1st of this year, so it took me 2 years.
Okay.
I thought that I would have been able to finish it in 1 year. And, oh, I'm glad you asked me this, because my son wanted me to make it a little short, easy book. And I was the one to do that, but the Spirit of the Lord was guiding me. And what the Spirit of the Lord was guiding me was to run a thread from the inception of blacks coming into this country to where we are now, and to show how the black man has been used as an economic tool from the inception of coming into this country, or even before then. Let's go back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, the Portuguese began the African slave trade in 1441.
Mm-hmm.
And these Africans were, you know, passed on to England to work in the factories and in her industries to make her the number one nation. And we're talking about the African slave trade now. And
mm-hmm.
five great countries of Europe participated heavily in the African slave trade. We're talking about Portugal and Spain. We're talking about England and France. And we're talking about Holland. During that particular time, the Vatican, the Pope, were in charge. And anyone
yes.
who wanted to engage in that African slave trade had to go through the Pope, the
yes.
Vatican. And so what really happened was that sometimes the kings had to get permission, and they used like disguisement to get into Africa to capture Africans and bring them back as slaves. The beginning was to on the pretense that we are Christianizing these people. We're doing
uh-huh.
it in that disguise, you know,
uh-huh.
those who did not know Christ. But then that was such a great desire for the African slave trade until they just stopped. They dispensed with the facade of being a Christian. They said, and by 1600, it was clear that the countries in Europe were raping the continent of Africa for the slaves. So my point with all of this is that the thread from the inception of the African slave trade ran all the way through to where we are, 21st century America. What do I mean by that? I mean that England had slaves and introduced them into the 13 colonies.
Mm-hmm.
And the most important document was when the 13 colonies began to fight against England, and Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. And what he wrote in that declaration, in that document, was that England had forced slavery upon the colonies. Well, this was really about to divide the 13 colonies, because the southern colonies had their slaves and they intended to keep their slaves. So the southern colonies said, if you delete that clause from the Declaration of Independence, we are not going to fight with you. And without the help of the southern colonists, the 13 colonists would not have won the war against England. So Thomas Jefferson had to rewrite the Declaration of Independence, and he had to delete that clause. And so when the war was won and the treaty was signed in 1783, you know that black people were still slaves, despite the fact that Crispus Attucks was the first one to die up in Boston fighting for the American Revolution. But black people had to continue from 1783 until the Civil War ended in 1865. And that's a long time, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
So the thread that you're looking at is the fact that God is looking at all of this. And so from 1865 at the close of the war, well, that should have been the end of all of the brutality and the lack of freedom, justice, and equality for black people. That should have been over. The 13th Amendment that abolished slavery in 1865 should have ended all forms of segregation, discrimination, all of that. But it did not. Because right after 1865, we went into segregation, discrimination, and then we went into the Civil Rights Movement, Martin Luther King leading the Civil Rights battle from 1955, the Montgomery bus boycott, all the way up to Birmingham in 1863, fighting with Bull Connor, and then bringing us all the way until his assassination, April 4th, 1968. Well, what truly happened was this. God is looking at all of this, and he said, well, you had the American Revolution, and black people should have been free, because Abigail Adams, the wife of John Adams, said it succinctly better than anyone, and she said, it always appeared to me to be an iniquitous scheme that here we are fighting for our freedom while we are holding other people as slaves. And I think that's the thread that should run through the American nation, that you fought against England for freedom, and therefore you should have given freedom to black people, but that has not been the case. So then we go through the Civil War. The war is over. But you still have not completely freed black people. They have to go through the civil rights, and that should not have been.
Correct.
So what am I saying with silence in the democracy? The Lord is looking upon all this, and what the Lord is saying, I've given you several chances to free the people, and the Lord look upon black people just like he did with the children of Israel. The children of Israel were held in bondage for more than 400 years in Egypt. But Moses delivered them. And Moses had to follow the directions of the Lord. See, the Lord does not allow a people to work without being paid or compensated. And that was a no-no for America, to abolish slavery and send them empty-handed on the road to freedom. That's a no-no. So that record is still with the Lord. That will come about. Okay? So now, with the book Silence in a Democracy and Prisons for Profit, you have to see it is how the black man has been used as an economic tool, and that which is most important is that even until the 21st century, you still have that slavery mentality in your economic, political concept that you don't want to free this man. And that's what God does not like. You see, when you have prisons for profit, when you use drugs to lure the people into your prisons, and you put your prisons on the stock market, you are going against the will of God. He wants his people to be free. He has given them gifts, skills, and talents to use on this earth to make this a better world. And he is omnipotent with all power. He is omniscient with all knowledge. He is omnipresent, present everywhere, ubiquitously, well, everywhere. You can't get around him. And therefore, here's the message from my assignment from the Lord. America must turn around, or God will send his destroyer upon this nation. So Trump's election is an opportunity for the nation to turn around. Now, never mind who feels what about him. If God can make a donkey talk, he can convert a man to do his will, and his will be done.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
ma'am. That was a lie. I'm not going to lie. I'm sitting here. I'm supposed to be paying attention to asking questions. I'm trying to take notes of what all you're saying. It's a lot of good information. I'm losing track. I'm trying to write this stuff down.
Oh, yeah, man. She's dropping jewels on us, man. I appreciate it.
Well, this what you kind of said kind of led up to the next question we wanted to ask you. In the book, you mentioned re-enslave. Explain to us exactly what you mean by re-enslavement and how did we become re-enslaved? What was that process?
Okay, yes, that is very interesting. The first colonists who came over were indentured servants. They didn't have money to pay because Europe had thrown many of the people in prisons, and they were just waiting on the time when they could find a new world. And so they traveled with the London Company and some of the other companies to get their little trip to America because they wanted to start a new way of life. Therefore, without any money, they just hired themselves out for 5 to 7 years. Therefore, you call them indentured servants. After 7 years, they were free to live their lives like they want to. Mm-hmm. Now, remember, this is the whole setup and the whole nation and for the whole globe, so you can write this down. The idea is always for profit. That's the title of the book, Prisons for Profit. No matter what, and no matter, we want to make sure that our commodity will earn us profit. Okay, so that's the whole story there. So anyway, the people were working for 5 to 7 years, and so the employers, the plantation owners, they were annoyed with this kind of shift. Every 7 years they have to retrain. So they wanted a permanent labor force. So they went behind closed doors, and as you know, the Virginia House of Burgesses was the first form of government in America. And so when they came out of their little meeting, they had a good idea, and their good idea was to earn the highest profit they could. And that was with the labor force. Now, they had tried to make the Native Americans slaves, but they knew the land better than they did, so they couldn't do that. Plus, the Native Americans were not, you know, accustomed to that type of strong, hard work. So then what they did was they reached for the black man, and they, in 1661, institutionalized black people in America. So they went into the whole institutionalization of making black people slaves in America. And you know the entire process. I won't go into all of that because that would be a long time. So blacks were made slaves in 1661. And so here's the idea. The idea for prisons for profit is that those people who sat behind the closed doors in 1970, and that's when they began thinking about converting prisons to profit or into an industry, the prison industrial complex. You know, what mm-hmm. they were saying is, okay, we need a commodity. The commodity will be the black man. We look back in history, okay, he was a slave back in history. And it didn't cost very much because we didn't pay him anything. We just gave him meager clothing, meager food, and we worked him from sun up to sun down. So it would be good if we can reinstitute this model. And we don't have to worry about being punished because guess what? The blacks worked as slaves from 1661 to 1865, and America never compensated them. So we probably can get away with this thing right now. We have them in our prisons, and we will set it all up. And so the cycle repeated itself. So what we would do, we would drop drugs in the black community. We would increase the police force, and we will expand our prisons. We will have sentencing that will not discriminate on who should go into the prison. All we want to know is that you got caught with the with the crime, and you must pay the time. And therefore, it is called modern day slavery, in my perception.
Yes, ma'am.
That's deep right there.
But the most important thing is the profit concept. You're not
right.
just behind the prison bars, but you are there because you are making profit for those corporations on Wall Street. And I have all that in the book.
Mm-hmm. All right.
That's
so
deep right there.
I know, right?
I must say that the two most important prison corporations in America are Correctional Corporations of America. That's CCA, Correctional Corporations of America, and the GEO Group. These two prison corporations is in control of 75% of the prisons in the USA.
Wow. Yeah, it's definitely an industry that is feeding on the lives, on the livelihood, and all the energy of black men, black and brown men. Yeah, yeah.
And that's very important because there are a variety of studies out showing that, well, of course, you know the largest percentage of people behind the bars of black people and black men. It's even worse because now, when you had the crack epidemic in the 80s, you began to get the women. See, prior to the women going into the prisons, the women could go up to upstate New York and all those different prison places and, you know, minister to the men, encourage them, motivate them so that they can sustain their time and come out. But then with the crack epidemic, you end up with women inundating the prison system. So then what happened to the black children? All right, so they are left vulnerable.
Right.
Select their models from the street. And so that's why another reason why you look and see you're doing modern-day slavery. But back to the corporations, I have in my appendix just a whole profile of these two corporations to show how they have turned humans as a commodity, making billions of dollars.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. That's something more of our people need to understand, that this is an industry who needs us to continue. So, all right.
And
so,
the sad part about it is that by being caught up in the prison, here you are wasting away your greatest, strongest years, 16 to 30, working behind the prison walls without even realizing who you are, what your gifts and talents are, and why you were placed on this earth.
Right. So we know that, you know, this book was placed on your heart to write. And you've had a 2-year journey so far from you having the revelation being brought to you to now when you have the book completed and the book is published and you're promoting the book. So what has been the most rewarding part of your journey? And why do you think you in particular, like, this book was placed in on your heart?
That is a very interesting question, and I'm thankful for the assignment. And first thing I did, I said, oh, I did do a prison industry back in the 80s and on, and I was able to organize a team to go to the prisons and to do, you know, interfaith workshops and do Bible studies. And that has been great for me because I was able to get in and do lessons with the inmates and inspire and encourage their hearts. In fact, the truth of the matter is, I don't even know, but just a couple of days ago, I received a letter from someone, I guess they received my note from somewhere. She sent me some of her poetry that she has written. She's, you know, in one of the female correction centers. And so it is being able to touch the lives of people and let them know that just because they are where they are does not mean that they have to remain where they are.
Right.
And just because they've been in a particular situation, it does not define truly who they are as a people. But they are a peculiar people coming into this world with great gifts and talents that they can develop and use to make a difference. Think about the work of Malcolm X. You remember how he went into those prisons and came out? Look at all the great work he did.
Mm-hmm.
But placed upon my heart, yes, because I'm always concerned about our young people. That has always been my project, working as a guidance counselor in the high school, to impact as many families and parents as possible. You know, to touch parents and let them know your children are your most important product. It is your responsibility to not only nurture, teach, train, and love your children, you have a responsibility to be a model for them and to oversee them and to supervise all of the institutions that have an impact upon your children. You have no business sitting at home not going to PTA meetings, not going to executive school board. You have no business sitting at home and not talking with your children when they come home to inquire about what happened in the school. You know, what I used to do when my son was in school, what I would do, I would role play with him to find out what was going on in the school. I just turned it back on him. You're the teacher, and I'm the student, and, you know, I get a chance to see what was going on. But it's touching base. And then sharing information with your neighbor. If you were to come together, two and three of you, and going up to the school, think about the positive impact you could make on the executive committee and watchdog in the schools, watchdog in the materials and the supplies that would take place. And I'm glad you asked me this question, because something terrible is happening in the black community, and that is that the career ladder is being destroyed in order to cultivate that pathway to the prison. So there are things that parents need to teach their children. We need to stop having children out of wedlock. That's another way of leading your children to the prison door. You drop out of school. You have no skills. You are unemployed. I mean, you talk about the unemployment rate. It is just horrible, you know, for blacks. You know, like the youth employment rate from 16 to 24. I tell you, it's over 18%. And then when you start looking at the dropout rate, the U.S. News and World Report, you know, last year showed that, you know, like 34% of high school freshmen, would drop out. But then we want to know what's happening, you know. And we have to start watchdogging our schools to make sure that we are doing our job, that we are teaching our children and following up on this. We don't want our children going to college taking 5 to 7 years to graduate. If you monitor your schools, you'll make sure that you have the quality teachers teaching your children, that the curriculum is correct, and that your laboratories in junior high schools are up to par. They are not just some shop room. And when your children reach high school, they are unprepared for advanced math. They are unprepared for advanced science. That's what we mean. And you need to watchdog your community and stop electing officials who do not service the community. It is not a free ride for them. If they are not of honesty and not of integrity to build communities, stop voting them into office. You have to nurture your children. you're losing too many children.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. You are speaking the truth, and it's action time for us. It's already been action time, but it's...
Oh, yes.
Got this. We have to do more. We have to make sure that we are creating these thriving communities for ourselves and uplifting ourselves and protecting ourselves, making sure our future generations don't have to live in poverty but can actually live in abundance. Because I often find it funny that so much we're so conditioned to existing in impoverished conditions that when you meet somebody who isn't from impoverished conditions, we treat them as if they not real human beings. And it's like, we're not saying their life isn't real, their life's just different. Like they didn't, you should want to grow up and not live in poverty and things, but like you say, we have to be able to set that tone so our future generations don't have to experience that.
You said that very well. That sort of make me regret to my childhood. You know, during our time, the child who did well became the model in the community. Everybody would say, now, you do like Sister So-and-so's child, you do that. And in that community, we had camaraderie. That is, yay, look, if I'm great in English and you're great in math, we're going to help each other.
Right.
See, we want to get our children to a point where they are mindful of short-range goals and long-range goals. What are you going to do within 1 year? What are your goals from 4 or 5 years from now, and how can we help each other? We want to get our children on a mindset. Say, for example, if you're in high school, you want to have camaraderie, and you want to encourage everybody in your school to do well, because guess what? When it becomes time for us to leave the nation, we'll be prepared in all areas. So in computers, in technology, all over across the board, you know, that's the kind of educational milieu that we want to get started. And we don't want to just set goals. We want to know the steps we must take in order to achieve the goals. I'd like to share this with you.
Yes, ma'am.
The two most important principles that brought black people out, despite the fact that they were not compensated for over 200 years of slavery, was the two things. They had their faith tradition, and they had their historic heritage, which you guys have been talking about all along, their history, and that's that hope. So now with the faith tradition, black people realized that, no, we have not been compensated, but we're going to take God and we're going to make it. So it was a whole century that black people made it from 1665 all the way until they made it to 1955 to Martin Luther King. They bond themselves together. You help me build my barn, I help you build your house. It was working together. We're going to teach our children to live by the law of God. We're going to teach them the Ten Commandments. Don't steal, don't kill, don't commit adultery. And so it was that kind of bonding that solidified the black race, as per se, and enabled them to travel from 1865 up to our times of 1955, 1968. And right after Martin Luther King, going into the 70s, we began to lose it because we dropped the faith tradition, stopped serving God, stopped teaching our children the good neighbor policy. We stopped teaching them to live by the Ten Commandments. And guess what? God stepped back. He said, all right, you got it. I'll leave you to have it. And that we lost a couple of generations with all of this. And then the second one was the historic heritage. And you said it earlier. In order for you to go someplace, you need to look back and be able to see that, hey, look, we have all these great people who've gone before us, so we have great contributions within us that we have to get out of us so that we can share our gifts and our talents to make this a better world. And with that historic heritage came hope. And with that hope, it came courage. It came tenacity. It came perseverance. In my generation, no matter what you threw in our face, it was not going to stop us. Our parents and grandparents had instilled us with that kind of tenacity. You do not let anything stop you. And you do not feel that you are lower than someone. You're just as good as anybody else. So they drilled that in us. And we internalized that. And as we traveled the road myself to Tuskegee, I carried that with me. And I can get out of this school in less than 4 years because the people at home said I can do it. They gave me the two principles to go with. They go with your faith in God, then go with the historic heritage of hope that you are somebody, or you have tenacity, and committing suicide is not an option. You
yes,
go forward, you trip up over yourself, you dust yourself off, and you get up and try it again.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. That deserves. We got.
I was just about to lean into y'all in the studio audience.
See, I told you the man with the little shirt and the sign, he had his sandwich and he good. Okay. Right. So, we're rolling into our final question. But we always set this question up. This is Patrick's question. So we got to set the tone for this question just like this.
So, if you were the all-powerful ruler of Black America and you could implement whatever you wanted to implement, what would you change and what would your message to the people be?
Well, that's a real full question. As we know, materialism is high on this list, and people have turned away from God to do materialism, and unfortunately, many have returned without God. Now, what would I do? I would, first of all, it's equality. I would bring on the 24th Psalms, that the earth is the Lord, the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein, that this world is God's world, and that we need to develop harmony, justice, truth, and equality in this nation, and we should not continue to do what we've been doing through the years, that we have set one group of people to be, you know, secondary slaves, and we've denied them an opportunity to develop their gifts and talents to be all that they could be. In fact, we've sent many, this nation has sent many back to their graves without fulfilling the purpose why God put them on this earth. And then you wonder why we have not found the cure to this and the cure to that. God has sent this to you several times, but you sent it back because of their physiognomy. Oh, he wasn't the right color and this and then that. So we want equality. We want freedom. We want justice for all God's people so that they can all perform and develop their gifts and talents. Now, specifically to Black people, when I talk about the prisons, and I do believe that the prisons are not democratic. I do believe that the prisons, for those people who are caught up with the nonviolent crime, with the drugs, they should not be in the prisons. But now, for those people who have committed the other violent crimes, then that's a different story. But what I'm really saying, we always have transformation. And I give credit to James Bennett, who led a prison reform in the 1940s, and he retired in 1964. And that's how I realized that the prisons were designed for prison profit, because in the 1960s, he had already finished his work, and he had used the theme Am I my brother's keeper? He was a Christian working in the prisons, and he designed everything to go as they should go. It was in the 1970s that the design for prisons took place and took shape because a group of people, a think tank behind the wall, wanted a prison industry. The first thing we need to do is abolish that. Get rid of the Rockefeller laws, and then get rid of the prisons, because the prisons are designed for 1% of the people, the corporations, to make billions of dollars at the expense of public taxes and government-funded contracts. Make this society so that it will be a society for all people, and you will not discriminate against black people, against Spanish people, against any people, but realize that God made people because he thought they were beautiful. That's why he made them the different shapes. So those are the kinds of things I will look at, because in general, people are beautiful. And we need to seek the good life, the life God designed for his humanity, to live in peace and harmony. Treat your neighbors as you wish to be treated. Share the wealth across the land. Humble yourself to God, who holds your breath in his nostrils and can call it in at any time. And you are off this earth standing before a holy God, giving account for your life before birth and death. So embrace the family, nurture the children, and build positive community. This will bring about peace and harmony in our world.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I love it. I love it. I love it. Could you tell our listeners once again the title of your book and where they can find your book, and also contact information where people can contact you and learn more?
Okay, thank you very much. The title of the book is Silence, S-I-L-E-N-C-E, N-I-N-A, Democracy. Silence in a Democracy, Prisons for Profit. And this book can be purchased online at AmazonBooks.com. AmazonBooks.com, and you are welcome to purchase the book and write a review. Dorothy Swigert, Silence in a Democracy. And Swigert is spelled S-W-Y-G-E-R-T, seven letters, Dorothy Swigert. And if you wanted to be in touch with the publisher, that would be Rekindle the Heart, R-E-K-I-N-D-L-E, Rekindle the Heart, P.O. Box 219, Hampton, H-A-M-P-T-O-N, Hampton, Virginia, 23669. Again, Silence in a Democracy, Prisons for Profit, a warning from the Lord.
Yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am. We truly, truly appreciate it. Yes, ma'am. Congratulations on writing and publishing the book. Congratulations on all the success that you have had. And I want to give you a few congratulations right now for all the future success that you will have, because this book will attract a lot of people. So you'll be on the move a while with this book.
I receive all of that, and I take it as a blessing, and I want all you and your co-hosts to continue to do a great job that you're doing, Patrick and Jamie. Okay, God bless all of you.
Thank you very much for calling in, and we will definitely speak with you in the future. Definitely have to.
Thank you. Good night.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Hey, look here. Y'all put y'all fist in the air. I got my black power fist in the air.
You know it.
That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. If you didn't know, now you know. And Kurt Franklin said, glory, glory. So there you go. If you don't know, now you know. Y'all make sure y'all get Silence in a Democracy, Prisons for Profit. Go to Amazon and get you a copy. And, you know, go ahead and enlighten yourself. She dropped a whole bunch of jewels on this. She did it Mansa Musa style and went on a pilgrimage and just dropped all the jewels.
Yeah, she definitely kicked out a whole lot of knowledge. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Y'all better get like Jamie. Go play this back. Pull your notepad out and get to writing it down and get to researching.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she gave you there's a whole lot to research in what she said. There is literally a mountain of information to research after listening to what she said, especially if you've never been exposed to a lot of it.
Right. So we don't have a guest next week, but we will be coming back dropping some information because, you know, Trump president. Now, so ain't no telling how long people going to be talking about that. But you know us, we don't beat a dead horse. But y'all make sure y'all come back and check us out. And once again, that is Miss Dorothy Swigert and her book with Silence in the Democracy, Prisons for Profit. I am Joseph Ward. He's Patrick Irvin. And he's Mr. Jamie Bouchon. Hey, man, we love you all. And two fingers up like a player. We'll see y'all next time. Peace out.